Well, Shabbat Shalom.
Shalom.
Today, as promised, we are going to continue through our book, my book report, Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case. Recall from last time that Frank Turek, the author, used this acronym. To divide the book into six main chapters. We talked last time about causality. The law of causality, as you'll recall, is that everything that has a beginning has a cause. Thing that has a beginning has a cause. So then when we apply that law, the truth is kind of brought out by logic. The cosmological argument then is that everything that has a beginning has a cause. The universe has a beginning. Therefore, the universe has a cause. Flip side of that in atheism is that they believe that something was created out of nothing. They discard for that moment the very law that science is based upon. Without the law of causality, there could be no scientific inquiry. There could be no research or even thought. Because, see, science is at its core a search for causes. All arguments, all thinking, all science, all aspects of life depend and rely upon the law of causality. But we talked about the fact that laws, though, are not material, are they? There's no causality molecule. There's no causality atom. Because laws are not material. So the materialist, the atheist, then steals from God the law of causality. He steals that from God in order to be able to do science in the first place. And he steals that in an effort to attempt to explain away God. But, you know, when the law of causality that supports science follows to God, then they immediately discard the law of causality and say it doesn't apply to the outside world. Doesn't apply outside the material world. Which then conflicts with their own view that the material world is all there is. So we saw that they kind of sit on God's lap and slap his face. So having looked at the atheist stance on causality, it doesn't seem very reasonable, does it? Does it seem reasonable? Does that line of thinking seem reasonable? No. They're supposed to be the champions of reason, the champions of logic. But when really pushed and pressed and to follow the evidence where it goes, really the clear reasoning, the clear logic, belongs to the theist, not the atheist. So reason is our next step in the acrostic. Reason. The main point of this chapter, this is taken off of the book here, the main point of this chapter is not to show that all arguments for atheism fail, which they do, but that's not what he's addressing here. The main point of the chapter is to show that all arguments for anything fail. If atheism or materialism is true. See, we talked about the fact that atheists are really materialists, aren't they? And that is a huge reason why the argument for atheism, all these arguments that they have, they fail. Because the source for a material universe can't come from a material universe. So the foundation of their arguments crumble. But as this says, the point here is not to argue all of these different points of atheism to show that they fail. The point is to show that if atheism, if materialism is true, then all arguments, all reason fails. It fails for every side. Any side of any argument, of any reason, any line of thinking fails if materialism is true. Why? Because just like causality, there is a law that governs reason. And that law is not material. Laws are not material. If there is nothing outside the material world, then there can be no law that governs reason. Follow with me. If there is no law that governs reason, then there is nothing on which to base any argument for anything. So what is that law? It's the law of non-contradiction. Now that law says that opposite ideas cannot be true at the same time and in the same sense. For example, if a car is moving, it can't at the same time be stationary or non-moving. At the same time and in the same sense of motion. It can't be moving and non-moving at the same time in the sense of motion. It's a contradiction. So the law of non-contradiction is a fundamental law of reason and logic. Atheists cannot take the results of scientific inquiry and interpret that data using logic and reason without using the immaterial law of non-contradiction to do it. In science, and science is nothing more than taking the evidence and applying and interpreting that evidence and using logic and reason to do it. And so they have to steal then the law, an immaterial law of non-contradiction, the laws of logic and reason that exist outside the material universe, in order to try to prove their view of a material universe apart from an intelligence that provides the logic and reason in which they're trying to interpret. You see what I'm saying? They have no basis in which to do it. They have to steal that from God in order to assert their conclusions using logic and reason that cannot exist within their material world. Here's an example of that from a question and answer session at a university between the author and a student. Frank generally gives these presentations, and he has a Q&A section afterwards. And this student named Michael stood up and asked a question. And this very short interaction between Frank and Michael. I want you to, I put this in here because I want you to follow this, because it illustrates kind of in a real life situation how the law of non-contradiction comes into play, using logic to follow to an end, okay? Because, I mean, it's very easy to grasp, okay, a car can't be moving at the same time that it's not moving. But how does this, what are the deeper implications of this? Okay, so here we go. So Michael stands up, and it's his question to Frank is, can you please explain to me how something can exist without time, space, or matter to exist out of? And if you can explain how that is possible, can you please demonstrate it? And Frank says, sure. the laws of logic that we are using right now. Those laws are outside of time, outside of space, and they are not made of material. Well, Michael comes back and says, well, then I argue that the laws of logic don't really exist. And Frank says, so you're saying they really do exist? No, Michael says. Frank says, yes, yes, you are. You are saying they do. Michael says, how am I saying they do? Because you're using the law of non-contradiction right now to say that I'm wrong. You see, Michael's position and Frank's position can't be both true at the same time and in the same context. Michael asserts that the laws of logic don't exist, but how did he do that? He's asserting that based on using logic, his own logic and reason, to come to that conclusion to try to prove that they don't exist. See? Atheists will assert that the law of non-contradiction is just a human invention, that it did not come from outside the material universe, but we evolved, and it's human beings then that have invented and created this law. God didn't create it, and intelligence didn't create it. We created it. Okay? It's been invented in our minds. And it doesn't exist outside of our minds. That's their position. Several atheists hold this position, obviously Michael as well. But here's where some sound reasoning comes in again. Frank then asked Michael this question. I didn't put it on a slide, but he said, before there were any, he asked Michael this. He says, before there were any humans on earth, is the statement, there are no human beings on earth, was that statement true? Now, any rational human being, including Michael, has to say that yes, the statement, before there were human beings on the earth, the statement, there are no human beings on earth, had to be true. It's obvious that it is. But you see, it also makes it obvious that the laws of reason and logic exist outside of the human mind. They exist whether the human mind exists or not. Why? Because there was not a mind when there were no humans on the earth yet. The humans hadn't invented this law of non-contradiction, the laws of logic. And so therefore, nothing could be true. You see? See, they exist whether the human mind exists or not. Because the laws are immaterial, they exist whether the material universe exists or not. And because of that, they have to have a source outside of the universe. And here's where atheists really kind of shoot themselves in the head. Because if you deny the law because it comes from outside the material, if you deny the law, then you have no basis on which to establish anything, in which to assert any logical conclusion, because then you have no logic or reason with which to determine anything for sure, including their points about atheism. See? Because they're not, it's just based on molecules in motion. Frank put it this way in the book, and I decided to put this in here. Here we go. He says, every truth claim, whether it is God exists or God doesn't exist, requires unchangeable laws of logic. If the laws of logic were changeable human and conventions, then any thought anyone conceived would be true, even contradictory thoughts. So God exists in one person's mind, and God does not exist in another person's mind, would both be true at the same time and in the same sense. And that's absurd. Put another way, if the laws of logic were just inventions of the human mind, then every thought would have to be regarded as just an invention of the human mind. With no fixed laws by which we could reliably ground our thoughts, we couldn't know anything confidently. That would include anything any atheist or anyone else said. Without the laws of logic, there's no way to know anything. But we get these arguments where the atheists will say, well, all truth changes. How would you respond to that? You'd say, well, does that truth change? Mm-hmm. Or they'll say, all truth depends on your perspective. Well, does that truth depend on your perspective? And it's not word games, guys. It's logic. That's what we're talking about here, reason. It's not word games, it's logic. See, they want to call logic word games when it comes against them. But when a scientist, an atheist scientist, uses logic, it's supposed to be gospel truth, right? But it's just word games when we use it. See, reason and logic will debunk atheist assertions. Why? Because we live in a theistic world. And so, because there is power, because there are laws, because there is a source beyond the material, when you use logic and reason, it will follow you through the evidence to that conclusion every time. Here's from the book again. The absolute truth is that it's impossible to deny the laws of logic without using them. They are self-evident reasoning tools we need to discover everything else about the world. They are self-evident in the sense that you don't reason to them. Get this. I'm going to read that again. These laws are self-evident in the sense that you don't reason to them. You don't reason your way to get the laws of reason. You reason from them. They're the basis, see? He says, they are to thinking what your eyes are to seeing. You can't see without your eyes. You can't think without the laws of logic. All thinking, all communication, all science depends on them. And because these laws are immaterial, they have to have a source beyond the material, just like all the other immaterial laws. Our atheist friends tout themselves as free thinkers, champions of reason and logic. But the irony is for a materialist atheist to assert any theory or argument against God, they have to use the laws of logic and reason that God provides to do it. They have to steal from God to make their case. And that's the point. If we are just material fleshly robots that are governed and controlled by chemically produced electric impulses, then we have no way to believe anything that we think at all. We're just reacting to stimulus. In order for there to be reason and thought, there must be a component outside of the physical brain. We call it the mind. Atheists contend that the mind and the brain are the same thing. Okay? But if that's the case, then they have no way to believe anything that they think. Because it's not free thought, is it? It's just molecules in motion. And so therefore, the atheistic view is completely self-defeating. If you're just a soft robot, you can't know anything. Because it's just reaction to chemicals and other things. And to say that it's, to say that it's self-defeating, that the mind and the brain are is not the only reason. Let me say that again. To say that it's self-defeating that the mind and the brain is not the only reason to conclude that the mind and the brain are not the same. Okay? That's not the only argument that we have. There are also positive reasons why we believe and understand that the mind and the brain are not the same. For instance, you and your thoughts, you know, who you are, stay the same, but your brain changes. See, as you get older, every cell in your body changes every 7 years. Do you know that? You get new cells every 7 years. In fact, we now know that approximately every 15 years, every molecule in your body has changed, has been replaced. So, tell me, if your mind and your brain are the same thing, if you essentially get a new mind, a new brain, every 15 years, how is it that you are still you? How is it that you still have memories before that? And that your thoughts and your personality and things is a contiguous thing from birth, you know, to death. See, your brain is material and it changes over time, yet your mind has these consistent thoughts, personality, and memories across time. They can't be the same. Next, your thoughts are immaterial. Aren't they? Your brain is material, right? Thoughts are not material. Think of something right now. Everybody do this little exercise. I mean, think about something right now. I don't care what it is. Think about an object of some sort, a car, a cooking utensil, any sort of animal, whatever you want to think about. So you got that in your head now? So if I came over there and cracked everybody's head open, would that object be in there? When we have accidents on the road and a motorcyclist smacks into a tree and splits his head open because he's too stupid to wear a helmet and his brain's all gushed out there, are we looking at the last thing he thought about? No. Thoughts are not material. Thoughts are immaterial. Okay? So if thoughts are outside the material, then the source of the thoughts, are outside the material. Therefore, the brain is material, but the mind is immaterial. Your thoughts are subjective, but your brain is an object. Your brain's an object. Scientists can poke it, they can examine it, they can study it. It's an object. But your thoughts are private. They can't go in there. They can go in there and they can pry and they can push on something and make this finger go like that or make you blink or whatever. But they can't go in there and see what you're thinking about. They can't see your thoughts. They're private. They are subjective. Your brain is objective. It's an object. They can observe the brain. They can see it. They can interface with it in that sense. But your thoughts are subjective. They are private. They are yours. They exist outside of that brain. They are in your mind, not your brain. Okay. You can intentionally direct yourselves and your thoughts to an end. And we're going to talk a little bit more about this next week. But not only does your mind have thoughts, something immaterial, but it also has intentionality. Intentionality. See, we can organize thoughts and immaterial things and move those thoughts to an end. It requires intelligence. Intentionality is another thing that's not material. It creates, it has goals, it has aspirations. If we were just a physical brain, then we would just exist, wouldn't we? We'd be controlled by atoms and molecules. Listen, a rock exists, doesn't it? It can't do anything but be a rock. If you are just material, you can't do anything other than chemically react to things as well. An immaterial mind, however, can not only have thoughts, but he can direct those thoughts to an end, to a goal. Okay. There's mind over matter, isn't there? Their mind, your mind can actually change your brain. So if there wasn't two, it couldn't do that. Science now understands that physical changes occur in the brain based on what we think. There's an area of treatment called cognitive therapy that directs psychotherapy patients to use their thoughts to create metabolic changes in the brain. How could that be if thoughts are also the brain? Another way to think about this, how could you explain the placebo effect in drug trials? You realize that upwards of 35 to 45% of patients in drug trials get the same result as the people that are taking the drug? In fact, in order to pass a clinical trial, that's why they give the placebo, because the placebo effect is so strong that you have to prove that the drug will do more than the sugar pill. And why do we have so many crappy drugs? And this is just a really side thing. You know why? Because it only takes a 5% divergence between the sugar pill and the drug to say the drug works. Anyway, that's sad. Yeah. In New Science magazine, atheists called a list, they have a list of 13 things that don't make sense. In New Science magazine, this is an atheistic magazine, 13 things that just don't make sense. The placebo effect is one of them. Right? The book spends really quite a bit of time giving quite a few examples of self-defeating arguments that atheists have that show how they try to use reason to do away with God. And the irony is, even though the arguments are many times circular and self-defeating, they are using the laws of reason and logic to make them. And that's what you need to be able to see. They're using the laws of reason and logic that don't come from a material world. Look again from the book. It says this, atheists claim to be champions of reason, but as we've seen, atheists cannot explain the origin of the laws of logic or ability to reason. No future discovery is going to change that fact. The category of immaterial reality is not available to the atheist, but that's what the laws of logic and our ability to reason require. These realities are well explained by a theistic God whose very nature is rational. In the beginning was the Word, or rationality, as the opening line of John's Gospel declares. Thus, when atheists put forth supposed reasons to deny a theistic God, they are denying the ability, they are denying the being that makes reason possible in the first place. So in other words, atheists need the laws of reason to try to make their case, but the laws of reason and logic are not material. They have to steal them from God. Okay, so we're moving through crimes, and now we've come to information and intentionality, which is chapter 3 in the book. And it says, God's signature is not just in the cell. It's in all of creation. God is as necessary to the universe, and I love this analogy, as a band to music. Once the band stops playing, the music is over. Now you think about that. Because when you fully grasp that, it encapsulates this chapter on information and intentionality. That band has to decide to play. That band has to create that music. And that band has to play that music. And when that band stops playing, the music is over. This is going to be the last chapter we cover today, so let's take a few minutes and unpack it just a little bit. For the material atheist, both information and intentionality are needed in order for their theories of evolution and other physics-type explanations to work. But they refuse to acknowledge that these things point to an intelligence outside the physical realm. Therefore, they need them to make their case, but they slap God in the face as they do it. Let's first talk a bit about information. Within this group of people, we've obviously talked a lot recently, and even over the years, about information, or what we can call programming, that is inherent in our DNA, it's within seeds, it's literally coded into every molecule in the universe. Do you understand that? Down to the very molecules. The atoms have to turn in a certain way to make a certain thing. You look at the element table. Every one of those elements have atoms and molecules that move in certain ways in order to make those elements. And if they didn't move in that way, if that's not what they did, those elements wouldn't exist. Okay? There is information coded into literally every molecule in this universe. Common sense will tell you that when you see information, you know that it came from intelligence. I mean, this is just, in a few short years, Bennett's going to understand this. It's simple. You don't see, Frank uses this, and you've heard it already, you don't see John loves Mary written in the sand walking down the beach and think the waves did it. It's ludicrous. You look at that simple message and you say, hey, somebody wrote that. Some intelligence wrote that down. Frank's other great example he uses is you don't come down for breakfast and see the alphabet cereal knocked over on the table with, hey, John, take out the trash, Mom. That's what he said. You don't say that the box just fell over and just made that. You know that Mom sit there and was funny about it. Intelligence wrote that. Never would cross your mind that simple little sentence, John loves Mary, was arbitrary by chance. Information comes from intelligence. John loves Mary has 13 letters. 13. And you wouldn't assume that it came by chance. Yet the materialistic atheist will tell you that the 13 billion letters in your DNA came by chance. How much faith does that take? If a 13-letter message in the sand can't be chance, how can a 13 billion letter message be chance? I'm going to digress again here a little bit. It's another point you might find interesting. Do you know that in the DNA, in the language of the DNA, there's only four letters? In our language, what, there's 21, right? There's 21. There's only four in DNA. Four. But those letters are organized so perfectly and with such efficiency of language that if you took and you transcribed every book in every library on the face of this planet and you transcribed it into the perfect language of DNA, it would be put in one book the size of 1% of the head of a pin. Every book, every library, every written letter by every man in the history of the world, written in that perfect language, would fit in one book the size of 1% of the head of a pin. We can go into, an archaeologist can go into a cave and see hieroglyphics on the wall and know that intelligence wrote it. I love Frank's example that you can look at the Grand Canyon and you can see that how time, of course we disagree on how much time, but time eroded this canyon. But we don't look at Mount Rushmore and think, oh, wind and erosion made the faces of four presidents. You know that intelligence did that. See, atheists can't ignore the information. It's there. And they need that information to explain life. They need it to explain how cells know what to do, how one cell becomes part of a kidney and how another cell knows to be an eyelash. They have to have it. But then when the source of that information is talked about, they cry that intelligence is not science. But it is. Here's a quote from a scientist that believes in intelligent design. And I'm going to tell you he's interesting because he does not believe in God. He is not Christian, he's not Muslim, he's not anything. He's agnostic. He doesn't believe in theism. He just believes he's a scientist that has looked at the evidence and says, hey, there's intelligence behind this. His name is Meyer, and he wrote this. He says, Neo-Darwinism and the theory of intelligent design are not two different types of inquiry, as some critics have asserted. They are two different answers formulated using a similar logic and method of reasoning to the same question. What caused biological forms and the appearance of design in the history of life? See, the reason Darwinists and Meyer arrive at different answers is not because there's a difference in the scientific method. It's because Meyer and other intelligent design proponents don't limit themselves to materialistic causes. They're open to intelligent options as well. So see, at the end of the day, this is not a debate about the evidence. Everybody's looking at the same evidence. This is a debate about how to interpret the science. And that involves philosophical commitments about what causes will be considered when looking at the possible evidence. Do you presuppose anything as you're looking at it? If you philosophically rule out intelligence beforehand, as the Darwinists do, you'll never interpret the evidence properly if an intelligent being is actually responsible, which is where the evidence leads. Accepting intelligence doesn't preclude a scientist from continuing to look for natural causes. It's only the materialist that is limiting their scope of inquiry. Can't accept where the evidence leads, then you have a burden to show alternate evidence that leads elsewhere, and they don't have it. It doesn't exist because the facts are the facts. And now we have such overwhelming data showing intelligence in the biological world that some prominent atheists like Francis Crick, Stephen Hawking, Richard Dawkins, these guys are now having to suggest that aliens came and seeded everything. Okay, the theory is called panspermia, meaning seeds everywhere. And it's funny how they can believe in aliens, but they can't believe in God. And then the next question, obviously, is where the aliens come from. But, you know, we don't want to talk about that. So it's not the information that is being resisted. They resist the morality of the information giver. So we're going to talk more about that next week, so I'm not going there. But information demands intelligence. The atheists use the information they needed to make their case for how they examine the scientific world and how life works, but they slap God in the face when it points to where life came from. They'll take it for how life works, but they won't take it from where life came from. So lastly, let's talk a few moments about intentionality. And this is where you kind of got to think a little bit. You know, you got to think about this a little bit. Because let's not even talk about life for a minute, you know, the origin of life. Let's just think for a minute about everything in the universe. Think about electrons and atoms. Think about the sun. Think about the movement of things, and galaxies and all of this. And realize that Aristotle came up with this back when, when was Aristotle? 1600s, something like that, a long time ago. Anyway, Aristotle called this final causality. In other words, everything in the universe moves towards a final goal, an intention, an end, okay? Even in the non-moving world. Or I shouldn't say non-moving world, in the non-living world. We see microscopic to the enormous being directed to an end. Electrons reliably orbit the nucleus of their atom. Okay? And they create, like I said, these elements. How? Because those are directed towards that end to create that element. They don't deviate from it. They move towards an end. They don't fly off into oblivion and then all of a sudden the hydrogen isn't there anymore. It's all directed towards an end. Everything is done with an intricate end purpose in mind. There is goal-directedness all around us. Even in us, biologists want to try and create macroevolution, but they can't do it. They jack with DNA and try to create new species. But even with intelligence involved by the scientists to try to direct macroevolution, it still can't work because of this goal directedness that is in everything. The goal is so strong in an embryo to be what it's supposed to be, that this biologist, Jonathan Wells, writes, no matter what we try to do to a fruit fly embryo, there are only three outcomes. We get a normal fruit fly, we get a defective fruit fly, or we get a dead fruit fly. Not even a horse fly, much less a horse. The intentionality of every living thing is astonishing, clear down to the smallest molecule. When you look at molecules whirling inside of you right now, they are technological marvels that each have an end. And they are so meticulous that biologists begin to give them engineering names. We have molecular motors, we have statters, we have switches, we have shuttles, we have sensors and tweezers and propellers and bushings and rotors and drive shafts and all of these things working within the smallest of the smallest things within us. And they operate with unrivaled precision. Do you know that the bacterial flagellum, that's what they call it, I don't know why,
flagellum.
What's it called? Flagellum. That's how you pronounce it, flagellum. So you guys are aware of this. It's they're motors. You can put 35,000 of them side by side and it's a millimeter long. That's how big they are or how small they are. This motor turns, Alex, at 100,000 RPM. And what's astonishing is it can stop and change direction back again to 100,000 RPM in a quarter of a turn. This is the kind of intentionality that we see in the universe. We can't create anything anywhere close to this. So for this type of interaction of all these multiple parts that all have individual needs that leads to an overall end to make something occur, like this little motor, there has to be something outside the universe orchestrating and providing a purpose for those ends. How did that little, and I still know how to pronounce it,
flagellum
come to be? I mean, I read it, but I've never heard it said. So, see, there has to be something orchestrating all of those parts coming together to create that. There's intentionality in those ends. Here's from the book. It says, let's trace it back. When you chose to read this book, or Dawkins chose to write his book, those choices and actions were dependent upon a series of deeper realities that are also goal-directed. In order to choose anything, your neurons must fire properly. And in order for your neurons to fire properly, atoms must act precisely as they do. In order for atoms to act precisely as they do, the four fundamental forces of nature must be in place and act in the consistent and orderly way that they do. And in order for the four fundamental forces of nature to... You see where this is going. He goes, well, you see where Aristotle and Aquinas were going with this. The layers of explanation can't go on forever. At some point, they must terminate at an uncaused first cause. Aristotle called it the unmoved mover. With everything in the universe working independently to a specified end, and then each all of those ends working together for larger ends, the intentionality of the universe is staggering. So we've talked about how fine-tuned the universe is for sustaining life. There is intention. And since that intention can be traced back and back and back, it has to ultimately land at an uncaused first cause. And that uncaused first cause has to be intelligent, and it has to have the intention to do it. In the book, Frank quotes this guy, Edward Fesser. He wrote a book called The Last Superstition, and he summed it up this way. Now go back to the vast system of causes that constitutes the physical universe. Every one of them is directed towards a certain end or final cause, yet almost none of them is associated with any consciousness, thought, or intellect at all. And even animals and human beings who are conscious are themselves comprised in whole or in part of unconscious and unintelligent material components which themselves manifest final causality. Yet it is impossible for anything to be directed towards an end unless that end exists in an intellect which directs the thing in question towards it. And it follows, therefore, that the system of ends or final causes that make up the physical universe can only exist at all because there is a supreme intelligence or intellect outside that universe which directs all things toward their ends. Now, obviously, this flies right in the face of the random chance that atheists and materialists offer as an explanation for all of this. How much faith do you have? What the reality of intentionality shows us is that even if the universe is eternal, now think about this for a minute, give it to them. Say the universe is eternal. Say that all life is the product of evolutionary process. You would still need intellect to guide that process to final causality. Even if the universe is eternal and all life forms are the product of evolutionary process, you still need intellect to guide the process to final causality. While the natural sciences help us discover specific cause and effect relationships in nature, the metaphysical argument from final causality explains why the laws exist in the first place. Because there is intention, there is an end or goal in mind that is evident by the way all the things work together toward that end. Many atheists try to avoid the problem by simply denying that final causality and intention exist. But what they don't realize is that science itself would be impossible because it'd be impossible unless reality was reliably goal-directed. In other words, science is looking for causes. They're trying to trace why this we see this cause, we see this end. Now what, how can we trace it back? Well, if in the universe there was no reliability in that chain, and there was no intention, and nothing guiding that intention to that end, science wouldn't work. They don't realize that they are displaying intentionality when they write books intending to make their cause for atheism. So, they unwittingly, again, the point is that they have to steal intentionality from God's world while trying to claim that He doesn't exist. Okay? So they need information. They need intentionality to make their case, so they steal it from God. So, last week we covered causality. This is information, intentionality. And in all these cases, as well as reason, we covered that today. We've seen in every case that these things are outside of the material, and that they need them in order to make their case, so they steal it from God. So that's as far as we're going to get today. I'm going to leave the question, the next section, for itself next week. It's too big to add into this. So that's what I got for today, or CRI so far. We've got MES to go. So let's circle up, talk about what we got so far, and we'll go from there.